Welcome to Leading with OKRs, the Agile Strategies podcast. In this limited series, Daniel Montgomery speaks with some of the most interesting people he knows on topics for senior leaders who are using objectives and key results. We talk about strategic intelligence, both human and artificial, how to build focus and alignment on your team using OKRs, and building stronger engagement, accountability, and teamwork.
Chuck Wetzel is an old friend, an accomplished rolfer, body worker, therapist, and meditation instructor. In this episode, we take a deep dive into the nature of somatic intelligence. In times of rapid change, cognitive flexibility, our ability to change our mind and see things differently, is absolutely critical. But the mind can't change itself. Chuck's perspective is that we can only get out of our heads by cultivating somatic intelligence, which can only happen through expanding our sense of our bodies and our repertoire of movement. Somatic intelligence, unlike logical intelligence, is a product of a complex interaction grounded in the body, which produces insights that seem to arrive in a single moment. We talk about practices for cultivating somatic intelligence, including mindfulness of our breath and the practice of pausing. Here we go. So I'm talking today with Chuck Wetzel. Chuck is an old friend of mine from graduate school psychology a long, long time ago, decades ago. And Chuck has had a long career working both in various forms of body work, somatic therapy, psychotherapy since then. Also a very deep Buddhist practitioner. So welcome, Chuck.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Dan.
Yeah, it's really, really good to talk. So, as you know, I've raised the issue, you know, there's so much focus on artificial intelligence these days that, like, what I feel is that there are multiple forms of intelligence. And I think that some of the at least more visionary proponents of what artificial intelligence could be, I think tend to oversimplify what intelligence is, because we've got, you can go on Google and ask how many kinds of intelligence there are. And there are various psychologists who've named, you know, anywhere from, I don't know, 5 to 15 kinds of intelligence. So certainly two of the more obvious ones are emotional intelligence, which is tied in with social intelligence, and also somatic intelligence. I think in the case with emotional intelligence, that's a hard thing to actually put on a computer. Although I think it's probably easier to do that than with somatic intelligence. And the example I keep thinking of is, you know, my older brother has Asperger's. And so emotional intelligence doesn't come naturally to him. But over the years, he learned, if I could say so, to fake it. To observe other people and just go logically, well, here's where I should smile. Here's where I should hold out my hand to shake hands. And it always felt a little unnatural, but you can kind of fake emotional intelligence. But I think somatic intelligence is a much deeper thing. And I want to, given all your years of experience, just want to get your take on what is somatic intelligence and how might it relate to these other kinds of intelligence.
I was thinking about that this morning, and rather than carving out somatic intelligence as a sort of a separate faculty on its own, there are those. I mean, if you're talking about, say, you know, cerebellar intelligence, the way that a gymnast can train, you know, highly refined movements, or for that matter, your average weekend duffer can work on a golf swing. Those are kinds of somatic intelligences. If you say social or emotional intelligence, that involves the body as well. So the one way to look at it is for somatic intelligence, importantly, it is, of course, as the name implies, soma, you know, meaning body, from the Greek word. It's body-based, and which would include all of the senses, and include vision and hearing, you know, especially as well as the somatic musculature, as well as striated muscle and smooth muscle. So the outputs from all of those integrated outputs, and that's important, that somatic intelligence is body-based, it's integrative, and it's holistic, meaning that the information that comes in a single picture, a single moment in time, rather than being sequentially processed. Now, part of that's going to be proprioceptive. So what do we know about the internal condition of, our digestive system, how the nervous system is firing, the blood is pumping? We have information about all that. And that is something that changes according to our environment. Our immediate environment is conducive or threatening or inharmonious in certain ways. And we have a patterning of proprioception that's very valuable information that we feel. We also have the kinesthesia, how we move through space. So it's very powerful to get out of a very a grid kind of movement that our culture has, to begin moving in curves and circles, and that actually affects perception and thinking. When we are observing others, we can invoke the mirror neuron system, of the brain in order to be able to feel inside us what other people seem to be feeling as we sort of mimic their movements and posture, as it were. And because we have this proprioceptive system in particular, somatic intelligence gives us information about our own emotional motivational system. Why are we doing what we're doing? And if we have, as you know, so very often we come up with reasons post hoc. We do something and then we come up with a rationale, but that's not really the reason we did it, even on something as seemingly analytical as a stock pick. Yeah, we do that for emotional reasons and then we make a rationale.
Well, so this idea about the grid is interesting because it seems then like, you describe the grid as something physical, but it seems like I think I hear you saying it's also mental. You can't really make a distinction between the mind and the body that way. So this grid is actually influencing how we observe, what we notice, and those kinds of things, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It has to deal in part with cognitive flexibility. When we move in linear fashion all the time, then our capacity to take in information differently, to handle it, it is limited. And conversely, then, by having movement systems like Laban is a Laban dance is very good with moving through space in curvilinear ways. And I can tell you, as a person who's engaged in that before, that at the end of a session, the world looks and feels very different. There's a kind of spontaneity that I experience because of the change in movement.
Well, and when you think about how this actually applies, let's say to a leadership team in an organization, I mean, what I see is as you described, people get locked into a particular pattern of thinking and reacting to events, which the more uncertain and complex the world gets, actually can become kind of dysfunctional because we like to talk about innovating and thinking out of the box, but how do we actually do that? And, you mentioned about mirror neurons, which is, the classic term about groupthink, that we do this unconsciously. Somebody says something, and most human beings want to feel like they're part of a team, part of a group. And that's an ancient survival thing. That's why exile used to be the worst form of punishment, arguably worse than death in tribal societies. And we still carry a lot of that with us. And so I think then, especially if you get people into a group, that whole kind of mutual grid can be really self-reinforcing.
One thing I think is worth mentioning is that when you're talking about leadership or planning complex sorts of activities, you're essentially talking about executive functions, which generally, you know, are served by the frontal lobes of the brain. And the prefrontal cortex, where all this happens, is an outgrowth of the motor cortex. So essentially what happened is all of the motor planning that we might use, you know, to locomote from one place to another became abstracted into planning what we're going to do tomorrow. What route will we take, or how will the company grow, or anything like that, is essentially an abstraction of movement through space.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, one can, if movement through space is limited, going back to the idea of if we're either moving along, you know, linear systems, or for that matter, we're not much moving at all. We're not involving the body, but we're only manipulating mathematical formulae in front of a computer. We're losing a lot of what the brain does to function best.
What are we missing?
Well, we're missing the way that movement actually informs thinking. That thinking devoid of soma is a poorer way for us to handle problems.
Well, okay, so we have this phenomenon these days where you have certain, you know, techno-optimist visionaries, as I would call them, who imagine that they could upload their consciousness onto a chip. But I think what you're saying challenges the idea of, well, what is consciousness actually?
Sure, absolutely. And that much of consciousness is somatically based. So like the idea of a self, you know, it's been described as being essentially an outgrowth of the homeostatic mechanisms that we have to stay within certain parameters of temperature and blood sugar and so forth. So that forms a kind of a proto-self. Then that, you know, that's the formation, that's the foundation of it, but it is elaborated more and more fully so we can project a future self into time and a future world into time and so forth. But ultimately, that's all somatically, that's the foundation is somatic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's actually based on how we move. So then, I mean, that to me seems to raise the possibility that, like, anything that we're doing with a computer is based on, you know, a highly elaborated set of on-off switches, you know, binary processing, which becomes inordinately complex, but it still has to be based on some kind of a model that a human being thinks is real, and prompts or programs into the computer. So, you know, I it's probably hard to say, but I end up wondering how far away are our current models from the reality of our own biological organism?
Oh, I'd say pretty far, just because of the complexity and the unknown aspects. I mean, mirror neurons that's a fairly recent discovery, just to use that as an example, and yet it's so very important.
Yeah, can you say more about what mirror neurons are about? What do they do?
Right. So it's a system in the brain of primates where if we observe somebody doing something, that fires in our brain. If they're making a movement, then the requisite neurons that would fire if we made that movement can fire in our brains. So you mm-hmm. know how somebody will unconsciously imitate a parent or a charismatic leader. They begin to walk and talk like them. It's not a conscious decision. It's not like there's classes in it or anything that say, now you do this or now you do that. That would be very awkward even if we tried to do it. But the mirror neurons just sort of resonate, as it were. Now, one of the importance of the mirror neuron systems is if you have spent time with your own proprioceptive system and you know, oh, now I'm getting irritated, simple things like that. Now I'm getting a little nervous. And you know what your body does when you are experiencing those things, then you can sense it in others. It's like I said, like this resonant phenomenon. It's neurological, but it allows you to now begin to feel what they're feeling.
Mm-hmm. So are you suggesting is that a way to develop empathy?
Absolutely. It's the
Okay.
basis of the absolute basis of empathy. So, there's different scales for all this, but if you look at the history of colonialism and how harmed vast numbers of people were by what was done in the past, that had to be a disconnection of that kind of system, because otherwise people would know what they were doing, the suffering they were creating. And they wouldn't have acted as they did.
Well, then you also have the phenomenon that sometimes the victim becomes the perpetrator. And it would seem like that actually makes sense from what you're saying, because you develop a habit, or like, Stockholm syndrome, you come to identify with someone who's actually not treating you very well. And that actually becomes part of your behavioral repertoire.
Yeah, I think that's well said. That's a good example, particularly with the lack of self-correction, where the abused person becomes the abuser. There's a lot to it, but I think that's an important aspect, sort of taking it on, as it were.
Right. Well, and I think about it, in my career, which has gone on for many decades at this point, I start thinking about the bosses that I had. I'm talking about the 1970s when I started my career, were very different than kind of the managerial ethos today, for the most part. Highly, highly patriarchal.
Yeah.
Highly like, I'm the boss and just do what I say. And I felt like I adapted to that. I was never entirely comfortable with it. But then it becomes a matter, if you're actually going to be an adaptive leader, you actually have to unlearn a lot of these habits that you've picked up from this mirroring, this grid that you're talking about.
Right.
So that raises the question, like, how do you do that?
Yeah. Well, I'd say probably the biggest commonality in all the different ways to do that is pausing. So it kind of goes back to the phenomenon of neuroplasticity. If you have a habit, you're really dealing with neuronal circuits, where you could think of it as like this neuron fires and it associates to the next, to the next, to the next, and they branch. And a given stimulus leads to the same set of neurons firing in the same circuit again and again. But when you pause, you come to like a branch in the neuron, and you just don't automatically go on to stimulate the next neuron. And that allows for a novel response, which is a kind of a re-education, if you want to implement a new pattern, or just a more of an equipotentiality if you want to maintain openness. It's like nothing has to fire in a scripted way. And if it's not going to be firing in a scripted way, then it can be maximally adaptive to the unique situation that's being presented.
So that is that an element in mindfulness practice?
Absolutely. Yeah, mindfulness would be a really good way to work with all this. Mindfulness, clearly, there's a ton of research how it develops proprioception, the ability to feel inside oneself and to know at the organ level, what's going on with health, but then also in terms of values, emotions, what's going on with unconscious processing. It's very good with that. And just to be able to hold an experience without having a reactivity.
Yeah. You know, in a way, what you're saying, it just sounds like, you know, your grandmother's wisdom, like, well, you know, before you say anything you'll regret, count to 10, you know, or take a deep breath. We can explain it more scientifically and biologically than maybe
Yeah.
grandma did, but this seems like perennial wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah. If as long as while you're counting, you open.
Right. As opposed
Otherwise,
to like,
you just delay the same reaction.
right. Okay. Three more and I get to yell at this guy.
Right. What did Mark Twain say? When angry, count to 10. When very angry, swear.
Okay. Well, he was a very wise man. That's great.
But you know, it's the lack of that pause to reflect. You can think of things like going back to the wisdom of the body, that, you know, the somatic aspect. We've, for many reasons, gotten into a culture that doesn't even know what and when to eat. Something as fundamental as that, and so we have widespread eating disorders. Which is clearly a case of the cognitive apparatus overpowering the somatic relationship to something as fundamental as food.
Wow. Well, and I find myself too wondering, I mean, you've been a meditation instructor and teacher for years. When we talk about pausing, I mean, probably the most basic meditation techniques have to do with breathing. Is there something in particular about breathing that's especially powerful for this kind of self-regulation or cutting through this like cognitive overload that we indulge in?
I think there's some aspect of that, but the greater thing is we seem to need some level of alternative to just going on to the next step, the next habitual step along the path. So anything that interrupts, in particular, a cognitive program, once there's an interruption, there's the potential to have a different set of neurons fire. But the breathing, of course, is convenient because we're hopefully always breathing.
Yeah, whether we know it or not, right?
Yeah.
But you're also saying, if I could, that it isn't just breathing. Like, you could almost over concentrate on the breathing. There has to be some gap, some kind of openness there. Because, like, what you were talking about with, you know, counting to 10, you know, there's got to be some little, gap.
Well, I mean, here's an example. You know, you're talking earlier about anybody on the autism spectrum, which Asperger's is now considered to be, you know, on ASD. A person can learn the scripting. You know, here's how you approach people. And actually, I have a friend who her major way of learning what to do was through studying Jane Goodall and how Jane Goodall observed the chimpanzees. And she adopted that method toward studying neurotypicals and got pretty good at passing, as it were. Yeah. But yeah, the thing with the pause, there's so many different ways to do that. There's also a problem, say, with kids who have ADHD. They're prone to not decode facial expressions well, and in general to experience aggression and harm coming toward them, either in an exaggerated fashion or where there's none at all. And a good pause for them is simply to stop and look at the facial expression of the person who's talking to them. And once they do that, they can actually say, well, no. It's sort of like in Buddhism, in the Abhidharma, they talk about how we often experience what they call a meaning generality, rather than what's there in the exact moment. We've made a model of it in our head, and we're relating to the model. And that's one of the things about somatic intelligence is it's much easier for that to be based on the stimulus configuration that's in front of us, rather than any stereotype about a class, a person, a demographic, by age or race or anything else. But to see them as unique, and for that matter, it's the person of this morning could be different from the guy last night.
Well, and then it seems like, there's been all this realization that a lot of facial recognition technology is subject to racial bias. And I think that's because, they're using some kind of modeling that actually isn't accurate. They cannot see the face of an African person as accurately as they see the face of a Caucasian person. But I want to explore what you brought up about ADHD, because whether it's more common today or whether it's simply something that's diagnosed that's always been with us, I'm not quite sure. But, I think, like what you said about eating disorders, I wonder, I mean, do you see any connection with what you've called this cognitive overpowering that we have in our culture?
That leads to lots of problems. I mean, people can look back on a course of action, some decision they took, and they say, I really should have known a lot earlier when I was dating this person. They were not really marriage material.
That's a practical example.
And yet, that those misgivings were overpowered by, well, they looks like they've got a good income, or other people like them, or whatever those things may have been. Whereas in the holistic sense of somatic intelligence, we can just it, again, it's like it's intuition, it's viscera, it's the striated muscle, but it's a moment in time when everything comes together and all the information is there. It's like when you look at a complex picture, you can get a flash of the picture, or you can start looking at different sections. Everything's actually contained in the picture overall.
I just want to bring this up because we were talking earlier and you had a great quote from Norbert Wiener. What was that quote again?
That we are not stuff that abides, but patterns that perpetuate themselves. Ida Rolf was fond of that quotation, just because in the Rolfing process, although it's working with myofascia, it's also very much working with what are the neural patterns that created that myofascial strain pattern.
Interesting. Can you please repeat that?
We are not stuff that abides. We are patterns that perpetuate themselves.
It makes me think of that famous Buckminster Fuller quote, "I seem to be a verb," that and I think this has to do with our language. Like we're very noun oriented, is it this or is it that? And our whole language kind of demands that we make these distinctions between things. And I'm no linguist, but from what I understand, there are other languages that they don't talk about things that way. I mean, they're much more about movement and that kind of a thing. So that's, again, I think, English language is very powerful. It's become a dominant global language, but there are,
It's very good for analysis. It has precision.
And I think that's why everybody loves it, because you get, I mean, I deal with people from India, China, Russia, who they all use English, and it really goes well with this entire kind of, computerized world that really got developed in the English speaking world. But that's not the whole world. That's not the whole thing. It's not the ultimate thing. And
Well, analysis is breaking things up into little chunks, and the somatic intelligence is unchunked. It's all one thing.
Right. Well, does it have to be one or the other, or can we actually find a way to balance both of these kinds of intelligence?
I think integration is essential. No, absolutely not one or the other. The problem is that our culture is so lost touch with somatic intelligence that, as you were saying, it's as if intelligence has been redefined as a certain sort of linguistic and mathematical capacity.
Only,
And that's the sole definition, but it's quite helpful. You have a decision to make. I'm going to buy a car, and you can do it to a great degree by looking at fuel efficiency and, repair histories and whatnot. But there's also something to be said for what does it feel like for you to be in that car? It's not just a question of outcomes, but it's a question of values.
Right.
And after all, if we don't have a value-laden life, what's the point?
Right, exactly. Yeah, it may not be much fun, but it's efficient, right? I think I read that in an underground comic decades ago, but I always remembered that term. It was sort of commenting on Robert Crumb's comment on modern life. It might not be much fun, but it's efficient.
Wow, that's great. I missed that one.
I still have a collection of those somewhere. Well, so it sounds like what we really need to do is develop more cognitive flexibility, which is more integrative, which admits of different kinds of perceptions, has that kind of open-endedness and spontaneity that you're talking about, has, you've experienced coming from these somatic practices, and so have I. I mean, I think that's actually a skill, or a practice, maybe more accurately, that I think people trying to make sense of things and move forward in uncertain times really need to develop. And, we've talked about how do you do that? You talked about pausing, opening, because I know, I mean, I've been meditating for years myself, and it still is a challenge to me sometimes to go like, wait a minute, I'm just thinking way too much about this, and I just need to stop. I can't make sense of this. And I need to let it not make sense. The world is not going to end if I can't make sense of this.
So a few more quotations. In terms of how to work with this, getting out of a repetitive and limited movement repertoire is very helpful for developing cognitive flexibility. So Moshe Feldenkrais said that what we're doing here in my system is it's not so much developing flexible bodies, which it does, but developing flexible minds. But that which it does was my parenthetical insertion. There's something about living and appreciating where understanding is somewhat more the removed analytical aspect. When we say somatic, it's inside us. It's not over there. It's not a distant kind of experience. It's in your guts. It's where you live.
It seems like kind of living, your primary dwelling is in the body, and then understanding when to use the mind and when to just like not focus on that, not worry about that.
That's right.
Be willing to be in a don't know mind.
And as you say, in an integrative way, being willing to use complex analytical systems, that's very helpful.
Because we're trying to act in an incredibly complex world that we have created, and that becomes the only way to do it. If you just imagine, like, you're some huge company with an international supply chain, you need those things in order to, like, okay, we need to get this kind of shoes to this kind of store. you know, in this location.
That's right.
There's no other way to do it. There's just, that's it, you know, and that's why these systems develop, because, you know, there's an economic value to them, certainly. Yeah.
And I think we've become fascinated by them because they've made such a big difference in such a short period of time.
Right, right. Well, and it seems like every stage of technological development we go through, we imagine that we are like the machine that we've created, which is kind of a curious phenomenon.
That is,
you know,
that's
so,
right.
So, you know, people, if you go back 100 years, maybe even more than 100 years, when, you know, people were creating like these steam-powered metal machines, I mean, you would see people using that as a metaphor for the mind and the universe.
Yeah,
same
right.
thing, you know, the Newtonian
right.
universe. And now it's computers, you know, now it's artificial intelligence, but we're actually just living our own metaphor. We're creating it in the physical world, but we're imagining that we are the thing that we created. And in fact, we're actually the creator of the thing. So it seems to me we're kind of disempowering ourselves. We're understating actually the creative power of what we actually are.
Oh, that's great. I like that. Yeah. So, I mean, there used to be more of this psychodynamic view of pressures and building up steam and letting off steam and one thing and another.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. Now we're reprogramming ourselves.
Exactly. Yeah. We're biohacking. Yeah. We're doing all that kind of stuff. That's so funny. Well, look, Chuck, this has been a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time. Just thank you so much for joining me. This has really been a stimulating conversation.
My pleasure. It's always good to connect with you. And these are ideas that, you know, they can be expanded so much. And
right.
I think for the benefit of our cultures. One last thing I'll say for the fans of Dune, the way that Frank Herbert had this highly technologically advanced society, the leaders of it were trained a lot in body disciplines. You know, they learned martial arts, they learned how to, you know, live off the land, how to orienteer, and all these different sorts of things. I think that's an important understanding of how the natural world, including the natural world of our bodies, interfaces with this world of complexity, so that it's a good place to live, and that we don't lose our humanity and let the computer programs run amok.
Well, and they had also consciously rejected some types of technologies. So, the way the movie is, it's sort of like, on one level, it's kind of this metallic industrial looking model of things, and yet they have, you know, interstellar travel and but an incredible development of psychic abilities as well. Well, on that note, Chuck, wow, we could go on for hours, but we just for our listeners' sake, we probably better stop and let them digest what we've said so far.
That sounds wise.
Okay, thanks so much, Chuck.
You're welcome.
Thanks for joining us. Agile Strategies is a boutique strategy and OKR consultancy. We offer senior leaders an agile approach to strategic planning and execution using OKRs and great teamwork. We provide training, coaching, and facilitation for strategic planning and adaptive strategy management using objectives and key results. For more information about Agile Strategies, go to agile-strategies.com. Agile Strategies podcast is produced by Sound Travels, LLC.